Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show featuring our good friend and legendary engineer,
Phil Brown.
Yeah!
There's a lady in a turban in a cocaine tree. And she does a dance so rhythmically. She's crying and singing and having a time. And don't let her go clean. Tree look fine, but you gotta put on your sailing shoes. Put on your sailing shoes. Everyone will start to cheer. So bad. This is the worst day I've ever had. Said happy, there's a misery, a very long time. Cause if I lay it on the line, but you've gotta put on your sailing shoes.
Robert Palmer and Sailing Shoes from his debut solo album, Sneaking Sally Through the Alley. And that was released in September 1974 on Island Records.
It was.
What a great end. It just stops.
Well, no. It's hitting sticks there for me. I think he's just hitting sticks together. But of course, that was engineered and mixed by Phil Brown. And Phil is a relatively new friend, isn't he? Although
he
sort of come into our lives a little bit of impact, because it's funny because we first got in touch with him through a friend of ours called J.S. Brooks, who has a studio in Leeds.
Yeah.
And I sort of, as I do, you know, he said, oh, you need to check out Phil Brown. And I'd heard the name, of course. And then when I looked into him, I thought, wow, you know, this guy's done so much stuff. And he's compared with like Glyn Johns and the sort of big name sort of engineers, he's relatively unknown. Or to me anyway. So what I did is that I bought the book, Are We Still Rolling?
Indeed.
And it's a, you know, I read it and I thought, wow, it's fantastic. It's a great book. We'll talk about it a bit later on. But so that's how we sort of got involved. And we thought we'd just do a show because listening to his music and we've read the book, we just wanted to pull out some tracks that he has actually sort of recommended as his favourite ones that he's recorded. So it's cool. So that's what we're doing today, a bit of a special show. And indeed, that was Robert Palmer. And backed by The Meters and the very sexy Lowell George. So talk to me a bit about this.
Well, yeah, it was recorded, the album was recorded in New Orleans, Louisiana, New York and Compass Point Studios in Nassau. And also, the overdubs were done in Phil Brown's house.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because this is what I love about this book, right? So it's all in different chapters depending on which artist.
I've forgotten, I've read it, of course, but it's a long time ago.
Which chapters he was working in, with which artist he was working with. So he was saying in his book, he said, Phil said, I've obtained a great deal of my studio work from meeting people by chance, either in a studio or backstage at concerts, or even sometimes on the street. And some of the time it was simply he was in the right place at the right time, and that's how he met Robert Palmer.
Wow.
So the story goes that on the 15th of May, so I love this, he knows the date. I love the story, the way that Phil describes things. You can really evoke the picture and the moment.
Yeah.
On the 15th of May, 1974, he wandered into Island Records' new studio, The Fallout Shelter, because he was going to go and say hello to his colleague and friend, Steve Smith.
Mm.
And Steve was
who produced this record, did he? Sneak it outside through the alley. I think he did, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
So Steve was in the studio and sat with Robert Palmer. And I love it. He said he was dressed all in white, smoking a Dunhill cigarette.
Lovely.
Beautiful image. So, and they were sat at the new Helios Parametric dress, and they were desk, and they were listening to tracks they'd recorded in all those different studios. And he sat in there for a while and said hello to Steve. Robert was apparently quite quiet and shy. They were focused on what they were doing.
Mm.
And anyway, later on, Steve asked him whether or not he'd like to work on some of the overdubs. So they booked in, which is a lovely story. So anyway, so they booked in, and they were working like 16-hour days, but random people kept dropping in, and the phones kept ringing, and they kept on getting disturbed, basically. And they were trying to work, and they couldn't. So Phil made a phone call, one to his wife, Sally. And then he made another phone call to a percussionist called Jody Linscott. And the next thing, they up camp, took the mobile recording studio from Island Records and drove it to his house.
I remember now, that's right.
It took an hour to reverse it back in through the trees. They were lifting up all the branches, right? They left the Jenny on the actual drive so it wasn't interfering with any noise. And they ran a cable, a power cord from the kitchen. And they basically set up in the living room, and he had another acoustically treated room. So they turned his house into a recording studio.
Fantastic. Bit like us.
Well, exactly. But it's so magical, and you can just see it, and they got on, you know. And what I love about this is that what you don't get with Wikipedia, and what I found with the book, is that I'm part of it. I get to know the people and the characters and more of the intimacy of what it was like to be there and what they were about, you know, it's about friendship, you know. They took that time out to go for a walk in the woods, they went shopping, they came back, and they worked just as hard as if they did in the studio.
Yeah.
But it was far more
productive.
Exactly. So anyway, so they did that, and then they went back in, and they were working, sort of doing all the mixes, 10 o'clock at night, and they were doing like the midnight shift, the night shift.
Mm.
Because the studio was so busy back in their main studio. So anyway, that's it. But what I love when they were mixing it, right? You'll love this, right? Robert Palmer wore a T-shirt that just said, "More bass." How cool is that?
Well, talking of bass, of course, on this record is George Porter Jr. from The Meters, your
indeed,
friend. That's
indeed.
Right. Because oh, God. This is sort of an in-joke for us, really, but what's that guy called?
Kid Anderson. On YouTube. He's so funny.
He does a great thing about talking about Sissy Strutt, and everybody plays it wrong because they always play the wrong note.
Oh, you've got to watch it.
You've got to watch it anyway. But, yeah, so he's on that. And also Lowell George. I just want to talk a little bit about Lowell George because when he's very famous for his slide guitar, and he sadly passed away quite a long time ago now.
Okay.
Well, many, many years. In the 70s, I think it was. And he really pioneered the technique of actually recording slide guitar. And he apparently used to use two 1176 compressors. We have two 1176, well, we've got four actually. But 1176 compressors, and he put them in series to actually give that very smooth slide sound, because slide can be very tricky. It can end up sounding very thin and stuff, but he used to use these compressors. And obviously, and I'll ask Phil about this next time I see him or speak with him, that he probably uses the same sort of technique. But what I do love about that, it's instant groove, and it just sounds like New Orleans, you know. You can hear the Meters in it. You can hear that little feet influence, you know. and it's great. And I just love Robert Palmer. And weren't we? Well, I was very, very sad when he passed away.
Yeah,
you know? very sad indeed. And you know, because he was a great inspiration for me in a lot of ways. Because he went from this sort of stuff, and then he went into sort of rock essentially. Then he went into Trick Bag off Riptide.
That's just
the Riptide
a crazy
album.
Track.
It's great. It's a lovely. It's a 12-bar blues, but it's totally done. It's all electronic, you know. And Johnny and Mary, we've had that on the show before. Anyway.
It was funny because I remember, and I told you about the fact that I got into Robert Palmer when I saw him on a late night show called OTT, and he sang Some Guys Have All the Luck. And I was like, oh, I love that song. And it's just, but Robert Palmer for me really is just an incredibly interesting artist because he went on such a journey.
Yeah.
That it just, you just can't imagine it. But
from what you read in the book, mostly fueled by Bolivian marching powder, but less of that.
My fear is my own.
Who else but Bob Marley and the Wailers, No Woman, No Cry, from the album Live, released as a vinyl LP on the 5th of December 1975 on Island Records. And it's my opinion that it's a definitive version.
Of course.
And this was mixed by Phil Brown at Basing Street Studios.
Indeed.
Which ended up, of course, being Psalm Studios.
Wow, get you.
Psalm West, actually. But it was known as well as Island Studios.
Yes.
And, of course, now it's run by Trevor Horn. Trevor Horn owns it and his company and ZTT and all that thing are there. And in this very studio, Did They Know It's Christmas was recorded. In the studio. So there we are, in the background. So that's a bit
of
backstory.
Your wealth of knowledge, you are.
Well, there we are. Well, the thing is that hopefully... you know, it is correct. I think it's, but it's correct. But yeah, and a marvelous. But it was recorded by the Rolling Stones mobile because Steve Smith got somebody else to record it, didn't it?
I think the Island one was booked out. So yeah. It says in Phil's book that Steve hired Mick McKenna and the Rolling Stones mobile truck to do the shows. Mm. This is quite a labour of love, though, to get Bob Marley recorded, you know, because
seriously, it is that way, yeah.
I mean, okay, right. So this song first appeared on his seventh studio album, Natty Dread, and Live was recorded over two nights, 17th and 18th of July, 1975, at the Lyceum Theatre in London as part of the Natty Dread tour. But what happened was that they tried to record Bob live with the Wailers a few months earlier. So they'd got this truck and it was at Leeds Poly and they were going to do some live album work with him. Yeah. And Bob sang the concert and basically the temperatures were like zero and he just literally said it was too cold, walked off stage, said it was too cold and got back on a plane to Jamaica. So
do you blame him?
So this is just like... really crazy stuff. And then they tried to do some studio work with him. So Steve Smith, Chris Blackwell, who's the guy who runs Island, asked him to go over to Jamaica, So tried to get some production meetings. And he ended up booking a studio in Kingston for a week. He booked it on the Thursday to start recording with Bob Marley and the Wailers, The first band member arrived on Saturday.
Well, I can imagine.
And then he said, don't worry, everybody on their way. I think someone else turned up on Sunday. Day five, Bob still hadn't turned up. So he just got back on the plane. Well, sod this, I got a life as well, you know. So they couldn't sort it out. So when they actually got these gigs together, it was really humid, apparently, on the night. And so they opened the roof to let some heat in. But a load of people gate crashed and they basically knocked down the 30-foot metal back door, stage door doors. Hundreds of people came to the gig that shouldn't have been there. And they basically knocked all the mics around. And so the first night's recording, it's all in the book, it's fascinating.
Yeah,
Steve asked Phil to check the tapes and they were unusable. So second night, they still got a chance. Phil went down to the theatre early with Steve and they nailed the blinking mic stands to the floor because everyone was hanging off everywhere because it was just like a massive party.
Yeah.
Everyone who was there and more. And they managed and they hung safety mics up for every eventuality. So they managed to grab it. Well, and that's how they got this recording.
Well, it's beautifully recorded. And what I love about it is there's that little bit of feedback in the beginning of the first few bars. You can hear it just welling up there, a bit of feedback. But to mix something, a live album, is always tricky because you've got a lot of bleed, which means that there's lots of live mics on stage and they're picking up everything, basically.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult, especially if you've got somebody singing quietly or away from the mic. You know, it's always a nightmare. And, of course, we're dealing here with tape. It was all tape those days.
Indeed. This is like the dark art, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, you can't just erase something or just, well, not easily anyway. It's really tricky. So you've got to mute buttons on an old analog console. So you're dancing around like Nijinsky behind it, trying to press all these buttons and, you know, a few people on it before automation, you know. But it is incredible, and I think I really love it. But the interesting thing is that early on in the 70s, talking about Island Studios and Psalm West, as it is now, or was, at that time when Bob Marley were in originally, you know, you didn't know this, you see, this is all new stuff, at the same time the Rolling Stones were in there, Bob Marley, and also Led Zeppelin doing Led Zepp 4. And Phil recorded the guitar solo for Stairway to Heaven. in the book. But you see, you haven't read that bit, have you yet? No, you did not. And apparently Jimmy Page wasn't all that good. Oh dear. Every man and his dog was on this record, wasn't it? I think and my favourite name of the track off this album, of course, is Big Muff.
Of course.
And for those that don't know anything, well, I'll talk about engineers later on as well, because the show, it's all about, you know, explaining what things are as well, you know. Uninitiated, but a Big Muff is a fuzz box, Electro-Harmonics fuzz box that came out. It's got a very distinct tone. And what a fuzz is, it basically makes your guitar very distorted. You can hear some very, very thin distorted guitar in the back of that. It doesn't sound like a Big Muff to me. It's a bit thin for a Big Muff, but it's definitely there going, it's that. But John Martin, of course, playing guitar. Stevie Winwood playing keyboards on this.
Indeed. How cool is that?
And the interesting thing is that the bass was played by Hansford Rowe, who was in Gong.
Now, I wondered who that chap was.
Yeah, great.
What a name.
Yeah.
Hansford.
But he was in Gong. We've had Gong on the show before. Yeah. Those guys were out there, really off their heads, you know what I mean? Living on the planet Gong, their own language. Anyway, less of Gong, more of John Martin. Just talk to me about his record.
Well, it was recorded in 3 weeks at Woolwich Green Farm. Which was it was a house, basically. There was a disused gravel pit. It was basically flooded, and there was a house in the middle, almost totally surrounded by water.
Right.
So Phil rocked up there with the Island Mobile, and they set that up in the courtyard. And this is what was quite intriguing as well, because they basically set up loads of mics outside and recorded outside a lot. So it says it's great. So he set up like two Neumann U87 mics, which are great mics.
We have some.
Indeed, on the opposite side of the house to mic up the outdoor PA, that the sound that was coming back off the lake. So they were recording outside, all set mics basically in all different places. Two mics down by the water's edge, so it picked up the sound of water lapping. And then you could hear the distant strangled sound of guitars as they were being played. So they were just really experimenting with different ways of capturing music, and they would play in the middle of the night. And so on this track, they recorded it, I think it was between like 3 and 6 in the morning.
Wow.
So it was just, they played repeatedly for hours, and I think they edited it together, and it was just the most amazing thing. And then people were like dropping in, like Stevie Winwood dropped in and played a few tracks. And you had, Dave Pegg plays bass.
Yeah, Neil Murray as well, rocker, you know. I mean, you don't expect Neil Murray to be on it.
Danny Thompson.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like everybody, as you say, in there, you know.
Danny Thompson was at that gig the other week with John Martin Festival, wasn't it? That was on last week.
Of course,
is
that the photo that Fiona put?
That's right. Fiona Imlach, our great friend, one of our great, great friends up in
amazing.
Yeah, she's love, and Fiona. Bruce, you know, and we always stay with them when we go up there. And but her father was Hamish Imlach, and Hamish Imlach, a huge folk musician. And he's
huge.
And he was very big friends of John Martin. So, you know, and we were talking.
Well,
about,
he nurtured John.
Oh,
didn't
yeah,
he, really?
That's right.
I mean,
we
took him under his wing.
Yeah, Phil Shackleton, we know, lives very close to us now in Germany.
Yes, yeah.
And that's very cool.
Phil's been great to us as
well. Yeah, really cool. So it's like a bit of a family. So with Phil Brown, and when he mentioned John Martin, we know all these connections. Which
it was
really
weird, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because totally. I know Jim Tullio in Chicago, who did one of the latter John Martin albums.
That's right, yeah.
So it's just really obscurely connected.
It is. And you know, the thing is, it is a great memory, because it was earlier this year, we went out for dinner with Phil, didn't we?
You did.
And it was just the most great, it was a great evening, because, you know, I'm not a very experienced recording engineer. I've been in studios an awful lot and done a lot of stuff, but compared with Phil, I'm an amateur, you know. But
No, say child as
well,
opposed
right.
to, because you're not an
yeah.
amateur.
Oh, thank you
no,
for that.
No, but you're not.
But it's like...
It's great you were speaking butchy. You were speaking the same language.
But he's got
Phil.
That
like
massive
almost,
experience, yeah. you know, and doing all this incredible stuff. But when I started talking to him, I realised that, you know, we have a very similar philosophy. And the way I sort of record stuff, even now, is very, very similar.
You were like brothers.
And,
it was yeah. quite surreal.
And
yeah.
what I do like is that he did a lot of the stuff mobile. He used to take mobile studios. And basically, that's what we've done. Because, you know,
that's
when right. we were in Valencia now, you know, we've set up a pop-up studio in Germany. You know, and everything that we've got is actually movable. Even though we don't have a mobile, i.e. a truck that has, like, all the recording
Everything we've
in.
Got is in flight cases,
yeah.
though, because we just move.
We're constantly moving, so we've got a new console coming in a couple of weeks, which is a Kadak J-Series, which sounds great.
So looking forward to that.
But it is basically a live console that we're going to be using, so we can just move it around in a flight case, just pack it up and we're away, you know.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely brilliant. But, you know, but Phil, we were like brothers, and we got incredibly drunk, didn't we, on red
wine. We were
like
children on the underground on the way back, weren't we, just giggling and everything. But I must say... The one thing that struck me about Phil, he told stories. He was honest. He was great and charming company.
Yeah.
And it was just really nice to have a chance to hang out with somebody who's unaffected, but could just really, he's just all about life and being.
And the music.
And the music, yeah, exactly.
And what I really think of the selection he's got here is quite laid back. It's very chilled. It's much more chilled show than we normally do, you know. Because
yeah.
There's a lot of reggae in here, there's a lot of ambient stuff, and it's just brilliant, you know. So really enjoying the show.
My dad came into my room holding his hat. I knew he was leaving. He sat on my bed, told me, "Some fat son, I have a duty calling on me. You and your sister, be brave, my little soldier. Don't you dare forget all that I told you, 'cause you're the mister of the house. Now remember this. And when you wake up in the morning, give your mama a kiss." Then I had to say goodbye. In the morning, woke mama with a kiss on each eyelid. Even though I'm only a kid, certain things can't be hid. Mama grabbed me, held me like I was made of gold, but left her in the stories untold. I said, "Mama, it'll be alright when daddy comes home tonight." Whether long range weapon, a suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether you saw a way, son, or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could a Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Could a inflation or globalization. Fear is a weapon of mass destruction. You could a Halliburton and run. Anyone, greed is a weapon of mass destruction. No better find courage. Overcoming action is a weapon of mass destruction. In 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 action is a weapon of mass destruction. Stops here. Let's be clear, this scenario is happening everywhere. And you ain't going to Nirvana or Farvana. You coming right back here to deal with your karma, with even more drama than previously. Seriously. Just how many centuries have we been waiting for someone else to make us free? And we refuse to see people overseas suffer just like we. Bad leadership and egos unfettered and free. Who feels
good Lord to make it all straight. There's only now so my people do it right, 'cause I don't want your daddy leaving home tonight. Well, the long range weapon of suicide bomb, a wicked mind is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether you saw a way, son, or BBC One, misinformation is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Caucasian or a poor Asian. Racism is a weapon of mass destruction. Whether inflation or globalization, fear is a weapon of mass destruction. You could have Halliburton and run anyone. Greed is a weapon of mass destruction. The better find courage, overcoming action is a weapon of mass destruction. In 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 action is a weapon of mass destruction.
Listening to the Supertone Show with Simon Campbell and Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
That was Maxi Jazz and the E-Type Boys, Mass Destruction, from their debut album Simple Not Easy, released on the 12th of August 2016 on Man in the Moon record label, and recorded and mixed by Phil Brown.
Yay, go Phil.
Now, I'll tell you what I like about that.
What?
The song. I love the song because the Faithless version of it is one of my favourite sort of songs from that sort of genre, you know. Great. And this guy is the lead vocalist from
Exactly.
Faithless.
I didn't know that, but Maxi Jazz is the lead singer of Faithless.
That's right, yeah.
And so there's Sister Bliss and Rollo.
Yeah.
And Maxi was the lead singer.
And this is a great version of it.
It's hugely brilliant. Yeah. I love it. The feel is just so chill.
I think to mix reggae or to actually record reggae is really tough, you know. Because
why do you think that?
Well, it is, because, I mean, the Jamaicans have it all sort of sewn up. Yeah.
Just have to relax.
But, you know, and this is, but this has got a contemporary fat sound. Look, it's quite, it's
a mix of fusion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not too dark. A lot of the actual true reggae stuff has got a massive amounts of bass. I mean, there's a lot of bass on that, you know, back on the kick drum and stuff, but the backing vocal effect he's using is really nice. I love that. Some sort of phase. I don't think it's a phaser, but it's something he's using. It even tied something or other, I would have thought. But it sounds really, really great. The horns sound fantastic, very tight. Great reverb.
What are they called now? I've got to know about them. They're called the kick horns, section.
Well, they sound like it as well because they're real, they're tight, you know, beautiful. And but it's a good song, beautifully recorded, and
they recorded at Rack Studios, and I didn't realise I say that every show because there's so much that I don't realise. I'm gonna have to stop saying it. It's like one of those repetitive words that I use. He's a Buddhist rapper as well. I didn't know. Mustn't say it. I've just said what I'm not supposed to say anyway. Well, what happened as well is that when Maxi wanted to, they announced they were going to split with Faithless, and just, you know, Rollo, who's one third of Faithless, is the elder brother of Dido.
No.
I literally found that out like a minute ago.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, yeah.
No, he helped write her album.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, he's done remixes for Simply Red, U2, Moby, Grace, Tricky, Suede. This guy's
holy
just
moly.
Prolific. Anyway, so getting back to Maxi Jazz. So when Faithless announced they were going to split, he was going to do a hip-hop album. And then he woke up one morning, apparently, and thought, hang on a minute, I've been writing some songs on guitar, and they're pretty good. So he went to his mum's home in Jamaica for the winter, and she let him build a studio in her basement. Good
Great.
Old mum, yeah?
Yeah.
So he started doing some demos there. And then when he came back, he got this sort of nine-piece together called the E-Type Boys. And they went into Rack Studios and they pretty much had finished cutting the album with Phil when Maxie got a call from Faithless saying that, you know, we really would like you to go and do a series. Could you come back and do a series of Faithless 20th anniversary shows? He said, well, I got my band now. They said, no problem, bring them along.
Great.
So the E-Type guys and Maxie ended up going and doing all these Faithless gigs. So, and he was saying that, you know, one gig is worth like 100 rehearsals.
Well, we know that.
So they played 8 or 9 gigs to tens of thousands of people on the Faithless anniversary tour. And when they got back, it wasn't that they decided that the songs they fused together. And I think they were more confident as a band. That's what he was saying. They decided to recut the whole album. So they went in for 2 days and did the whole thing again.
Great.
And it wasn't that Phil or they hadn't done a great job to start with. It was just, you know, a different vibe. It was more
fused. You get tighter and, you know. Yeah. And that is it's a beautifully recorded record and, you know, beautifully played. You know, it sounds great, doesn't it?
And also, yeah, and Maxie wrote on Facebook, thank you, Phil Brown. You polish and polish till it all sounds great.
Thank you.
Talk Talk. I Believe in You, and that's from their fourth studio album, Spirit of Eden, and that was released on the 16th of September in 1988 on the Parlophone EMI record label.
A very torturous recording process, I believe, according to the book. And Mark Collis, of course, who sadly passed away very recently, who was, you know, the major domo behind this, really. It was like, you know, Tim Fries-Greed produced it, Phil recorded it. It's a piece of work which is truly remarkable. And so much so, Alan McGee, the famous Alan McGee, wrote, Spirit of Eden is not dated. It's remarkable how contemporary it sounds, anticipating post-rock, the Verve and Radiohead. Really? It's the sound of the artist being given the keys to the kingdom and returning with art. Now, because it took ages, it took ages to do. And
well, that's because they'd had a really successful album before The Colour of Spring.
That's right.
So basically the EMI executives gave them free rein on the next album, and they were the managers were banned from the studio, and they could do what they want.
Yeah. But you see, this is the thing. You give great artists time. It's like the Beatles had a completely run of, you know, Abbey Road.
They did.
For years. And you give them time and they come up with a masterpiece. And, you know, at the time, it didn't sell a lot of records because they all thought it was going to be very successful.
Well, they wanted more of the same, but really, Mark Hollis was coming out, wasn't he? In terms of he was actually being more expressive in terms of who he was as a musician. Everyone knew that those influences were there. So, yeah, I think, I mean, it's crazy, really, because it's, yes, I mean, when you say it was arduous, no, what it was is that they were going in and working overnight, and it was in the morning they'd go in, but they'd make it look like night. That was the thing.
Totally dark.
So the guys, that they set up an oil projector in the studio, and they burned incense, and they had, I love this, some disco light, sound-activated lights around the drum kit. And it was great. I love that. Put rugs around, you know, and they made it sort of like a completely different. It was like going back to the 70s when they were recording. So they were like in a time warp. And they were using it as a time for experimentation. So they were trying every which way but loose, basically. And I think that's really why. And when you say it's torturous, because it just went on for like months and months and months.
Yeah,
but that's cool, you know.
They tried every overdub imaginable and stuff. They brought a choir in for that, didn't they? You can just hear him at the end.
Yeah, but originally it was a 25-piece choir, but Mark felt that it sounded too perfect, too good, so they just got in six lads instead to from Chelmsford Cathedral.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really cool, isn't it? No, I love that. I mean, and I know it wasn't commercial. I think EMI just thought they were getting something else. And I know there was a bit of a legal battle over it, really, because they wanted something commercially satisfactory. I think they've changed the get out clause now, as opposed to, I think it was something about technical, but it's nothing to do with technicality.
No.
The clauses in contracts, then the get out clause. So now it's more like we need more of the same to be commercial. And that's where people get caught out, really. But what a fantastic experience just to, I know it was draining because, you know, Phil didn't even know which time of the year it was sometimes, you know. It was just because it was just, it was like so arduous, and at the same time you can almost feel it, so magnificent. Yeah. You had pleasure and pain at the same time.
And he was credited for bowed guitar. On that. Even though he can't play guitar, they got him into play.
Well, be careful what you wish for as well, because he suggested, apparently, because there was a working title of this. What was it called? Snow in Berlin. That's what it was originally called. And Phil apparently suggested to Mark, it's like, this sounds really good with bowed guitar. And Mark just said, well, go on then. Here's a guitar, here's a bow. He said, but I can't play. He said, well, come on, you can do it. Just play some, do it. And he did.
Well, we're going to be listening to the whole of this album again tomorrow. I'm doing lunch, I think. That's a good idea.
Oh, fantastic, though. But what lovely stories. I love this book.
Ruthie, in your bed. Down your wistful hair and float across the drawbridge to my mind, come waft across my crimson mound.
I'd rather you did that than let the elder men stand and gloat. Although I'm so much younger in my eyes, my thoughts are so much older than the lies. My face seems too dead. Just let me turn you on. Ruthie, take before your chance has gone. I see a world of lemon smiles on people crossing gates and stars. Dance with grass and scattered dust. Oh, come and share a moment with me, Lord. My material only lights them down in blue. Oh, will you find Elysia?
Murray Head, Ruthie, from his first album, Nigel Lived, released in 1973 on CBS Records and recorded at the marvellous Olympic Studio 2 and engineered by Phil Brown.
Yay.
As far from One Night in Bangkok as you can get.
I didn't know it was the same guy.
Yeah.
And at that time as well, Murray Head was a famous actor. He'd starred in Sunday, Bloody Sunday, alongside Peter Finch and Glenda Jackson. And his character was bisexual, and it was the first movie to show a passionate kiss between two men.
No.
Oh, yeah, there was a real sort of to-do on set and everything. Apparently the camera guy got off and said, "Is this really necessary?" And the director, John Schlesinger, said, "It's the most important scene in the whole film." So anyway, so Phil did the engineering on this with Murray Head. So Phil met up with Murray at Toad Hall, which was his house, his flat actually on Fulham Road, and they chatted about it. It was Phil's first experience for recording outside and using mobile trucks. That's when he first met producer Steve Smith.
Ah, right.
And they went out like in the middle of the night, him and Murray Head, and they were like filming saxophonists playing down tunnels. Phil even had like a portable tape machine strapped to his back with a secret mic down his sleeve.
No.
They were off like chatting.
I've forgotten about this. Yeah,
to like railway conductors or station managers.
Amazing.
So they did this incredible kind of like mixing in of live sounds and everything. It was a complete creative masterpiece. And in 2017, Intervention Records reissued Nigel Lived on 180 gram double vinyl. And the reissue, Phil remastered it.
Wow.
Again. So that was fantastic.
And I have to get that. We haven't got that.
And it was the most successful album that Intervention had ever released.
Wow.
And Murray Head went back out singing on the road because of that.
Fantastic.
So in a nutshell, thank you for joining us this week. It's been about Phil Brown, who's the engineer who's got an amazing load of stories. He's worked with T-Rex, Traffic, Jimi Hendrix, Joe Cocker, Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin, Harry Nilsson, Brian Eno, Dire Straits, Robert Plant, Dido, Tricky, Dave Gilmour, Jarvis Cocker, everybody. It's just Laura Marling, Marty Pelo.
It's a great book. You must read it. Yeah.
But I can't believe that he's worked with all these people. David Bowie, crazy. And it's all in his book, Are We Still Rolling? And Phil wrote, albums I've had a percentage on have died a death, and others like Dido's, which sold 20 million, I've had nothing. It's fine. Working with the biggest acts brings baggage, you know, and he says, I hate the circus, all these things on mobile phones, you've got nothing to do with making the record. I've reached the point where I want sessions to be enjoyable, and I'll take less money to do that.